Hi, James. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, always a pleasure to be here and always a pleasure to talk to Grandpa Liberty.
Well, why don't you go right ahead and give us your impression? Certainly, gold and silver are staying down, seem to be coming back a little bit. Certainly, gold, oil took quite a drop. So what's really going on from your point of view?
Well, in fact, gold is doing pretty well. It's had its biggest week in 18 months, and it's quite interesting to look at the contrast from last week with the $200 drop in 2 days versus what's happening now, which shows that gold is pretty much regaining a lot of the loss that it had there. In fact, it's up back at around the 1420 level now. It actually spiked up to 1440 earlier in the day today, so it is regaining a lot of what it lost there, and it's interesting to compare this to the types of doom and gloom the gold bust has come that was being written about by the usual purveyors of the mainstream opinion last week. It's very interesting to look at the contrast with this week and see what's actually happening here, because again, it goes to show that the actual physical demand for gold is still not only high, it's in some places at all-time highs. In fact, we had recent reports with from China that they haven't seen this amount of a gold rush in 20 years. So again, there's incredible physical demand, and they just can't keep that price suppressed for very long, no matter how much paper manipulation they attempt.
Well, my understanding is that there's been a tremendous demand from India as well. Is that true?
Absolutely. India always a strong market, and especially so when they see a big dip like this. Everyone wants to buy the dip.
All right, fine. Well, ladies and gentlemen, basically we have a fiat money system. There's no instance in all history where a fiat money system has survived, and suddenly when this one goes down, why, people who suddenly have pensions, people who have suddenly the money invested in bonds or conventional investments, I fear many of them are going to be totally wiped out. Our goal is to just stand on the out here and try to get people to make preparation for the difficult times that lie ahead. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. I guess this afternoon is James Corbett. And James, at this time, of course, we always bring the new listeners in. So why don't you just go ahead and give our, and you can repeat what you just said. Certainly, we have give us a summary of what's going on in the markets, not only in the United States, but throughout the world today.
Well, again, just to reiterate what we were saying, the gold markets have started their recovery. They're now trading around the 1426 mark, and that represents the biggest increase, the biggest week in gold for 18 months. So it's been quite a bit of a recovery, and again, it's interesting to contrast that with what was being said immediately after the big drop that we had last week, where people were saying this represents a fundamental change of opinion in the markets and that gold is no longer needed as a hedge because people have faith in the money printing, et cetera, et cetera. All these types of ridiculous theories that were being spun at that time seem to be in the waste paper basket of history at this point, because again, it shows that gold is recovering apace after the paper market shorting that we saw last week. And again, this just goes to show the bigger disconnects that are happening with the economy generally, and we're seeing that not only with the incredible performance that the S&P has had over the past few years, the big run-up that we've seen here in the stock market is another sign of this disconnect, because of course the macro figures again are showing a global cooling off in the global economy, but that is yet to be reflected in the actual stock market. And I think one of the big reasons for that, although we have seen a bit of a cooling off recently, but one of the big reasons we've seen this big run up in general is because people are trying to find ways to put their money in other assets that will actually see some sort of increase in value, because we all know that this big devaluation is occurring right now with all this paper money printing. So the markets are looking for places to put their money, and and Japan here where I am has just added another big piece to that puzzle, as now basically the entire nation of Japan is incentivized to take all of their savings, which they've had effectively stuffed in their mattresses here, either in bank accounts or in Japanese government bonds, and to put them into something useful before the yen is inflated away. way into nothing. So we're starting to see the markets beginning to price in the idea that Japan is going to go on a big global shopping spree to try to get rid of some of their increasingly worthless yen. And we're seeing that already priced into the markets. So I think there's a big disconnect happening between what's actually happening and what people are doing with their money. And I think that's going to start catching up at a certain point.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and James is simply saying that the people over in Japan now, because the government is over there, is intent upon inflating away the value of their currency. In other words, they're printing a lot more money so they can lower the value of the yen and make their products more competitive throughout the world. In other words, it'll be much cheaper to buy a Toyota car here in the United States. Than it has been in the past, and in other countries it'd be cheaper to buy Japanese products because, of course, they're decreasing and destroying the value of the currency, which works fine as far as increasing your automotive production. But what it does is destroy the value of the life savings of the average Japanese. Now, basically in Japan, they have certainly a situation where they actually have the national debt is about almost 2.5 times what the gross domestic product is. In other words, they have the largest debt to gross domestic product in the world. And surely this is based on the fact that a lot of the Japanese are investing in government bonds. But they realize the money they have in government bonds is being progressively eroded as they destroy the value of the yen. And so the Japanese are beginning, Chris, to try to get out of their own currency. And where are they investing then, James?
Well, I think so far this hasn't actually taken place. So I think it's more of a guessing game at this point where the money is going to end up. But a lot of the high-yielding assets on the global markets are starting to increase in the stock market, which would indicate that basically the markets are betting that we're going to be looking at for example, the U.S. stocks or bonds or things like that as a safe haven for Japanese investors. But again, I think this is all very speculative right now, and there's no indication that this move is taking place yet, as I don't think it's really hit home with a lot of the Japanese public quite yet that their very, very long-time strategy of simply saving yen is not going to work anymore in an inflationary environment. Because it's important to keep in mind, again, that Japan has for over two decades now been in deflation. The idea that just parking your money in a bank account, even if it's not earning any interest at all, is still a better place to put it than a lot of other riskier assets might be, because it's actually increasing in purchasing power as it sits there. But we move into this inflationary environment, and that completely changes the calculus. So I think it's going to take a while now before the average Japanese investor actually starts to realize what's happening, because again, this has been ingrained into the population for at least a generation. And that's why we see such incredibly high saving rates in the country. But it's also important to realize that the quantitative easing that's happening in Japan is going to be different than what's happening in the U.S. We've talked before about how the Federal Reserve is printing a lot of money, but that money isn't necessarily making its way into the markets. It isn't actually trickling down, which is why it hasn't had such an incredibly inflationary effect in America yet. But in Japan, a lot of what the BOJ is doing is centering around the idea of direct stimulus directly into the economy, which if and when that's implemented will have that inflationary effect. So I think it's going to be different here in Japan than what it's looked like in the U.S. so far.
Of course, I think the United States is going to get into problems as far as inflation as well, don't you think? Certainly, we've massively increased the money supply. I think it's somewhere pretty close to $3 trillion. It used to be, I can remember, where we had $100 billion in circulation. That was the M1, and now it's, I don't know where it is, but it's awfully high now. We've increased that many, many fold. And down the line, sooner or later, isn't it going to have a massive inflationary impact upon our economy once that money begins to move and move more rapidly as they increase the velocity of money?
Well, that's exactly right. As soon as the money starts to actually make its way down into the market and starts to get exchanged, that's when we will see that inflationary effect. Another possibility, of course, is that we will see a breaking point reached when this starts to affect the exchange value of the U.S. dollar. So when right now, of course, the U.S. dollar is relative to, for example, the euro or the Japanese yen or some of the other leading currencies is relatively strong, quote unquote. Of course, it isn't actually strong or sound, but it's just a little bit better than the other currencies out there. So it's the best looking house in a very bad neighborhood at this point. But if and when this starts to affect the exchange value of the U.S. dollar versus those other currencies, that becomes the point at which the Fed can no longer really keep the lid on those interest rates. And at that point, I think inflation will start to really tear into the American markets. So there's a couple of different ways for this to occur, but I think it is pretty much inevitable at this point, just given the amount of money that's on the books. The only way out of this, or only other way that this could play out, of course, is if there was a complete drop off in consumer demand. If no one was buying anything, if no goods were changing hands, we could actually see a deflationary spiral in all of this, which would not play well for people who are creditors. For people who are taking loans rather than people who have them. Inflation is good for people who are actually in debt because it inflates down the value of what they're in debt for. And deflation would have the exact opposite effect. So it really does depend on the situation people are in, which type of collapse might work out better for them. But at any rate, I think we are looking of a collapse at some point coming in the near future.
All right, fine. Well, certainly it sounds from everything I hear is that the economy of many of the nations over there in Europe is beginning to contract, and certainly a tremendously high unemployment rate in Japan and Greece. What is it, 26-27% of the adult population is unemployed, well over 50% of the 20 to 30 years of age are unemployed. Those are disastrous levels. How long can Greece and the other countries in Southern Europe continue running such high unemployment rates and really such massive deficits, because most of them are running deficits, aren't they?
Yes, they are. And this is an extremely important point of all of this. In fact, I think there are longer term trends that people aren't really paying attention to that might play into all of this, including the fact that, for example, we just saw the Spanish population declining for the first time as immigration is down over the past year. So we actually saw a decline of 206,000 people in the Spanish population. That's important because, again, if people are staying away from Europe, I mean, obviously, like so many other basically Western industrialized countries, the only thing that's keeping that population up is immigration. And if it is a less attractive place for immigrants to actually move to, we could see the start of the demographic winter that we're seeing in other countries, like here in Japan as well. So this is another bigger wild card in the mix, because again, so much of the industrial capacity and the tax base of these countries depends on people wanting to move there. And as we're seeing the sort of disintegration of Europe in so many other ways, we're also starting to see perhaps the wheels coming off of the immigration bandwagon, meaning that we might start to see stagnation in Europe generally in terms of population. And again, it's obviously just at the very, very, very beginning of such a curve, if that's what we're seeing. But still, that's one of those things that could play into this in the longer term.
Well, you live in Japan. You would certainly be well aware of what's going on over there. My impression is that, first of all, Japan has a very low reproduction rate. Its fertility rate's about 1.2 children per family, which means, of course, that basically you're not reproducing their own population. And Japan is certainly unique in that they've discouraged immigration, in other words, discouraged people from other countries coming to live there. So gradually, isn't their population beginning to contract? And down the line, won't this have disastrous effects? And isn't there certainly a great deal of problem still as far as Fukushima is concerned and the radiation spilling out over that area? What are your thoughts on certainly on what's going on in Japan today?
Absolutely. It's a very worrying situation here. In fact, I'd almost say, I mean, there's a perfect storm of events over here, not only with what we've been talking about with the Bank of Japan wanting to inflate away the value of the yen, but as you say, Fukushima is still ongoing, and although it's not being covered anymore, for example, we've just had a situation over the past couple of weeks where there were some major leaks in one of the underground storage containers of some of the water that they've been using to cool the reactors has been leaking out, and they've had some massive problems trying to get that under control. So there are still very much ongoing problems at the Fukushima plant. And as you say, the Japanese population is graying. It is already the oldest population in the world, and that trend is only increasing as the birth rate falls. And I believe you're right; it's somewhere around the 1.2 or 1.3 mark right now for children per couple. And in fact, just in 2012, we saw the biggest decrease in record for the Japanese population. Japan's population fell by 284,000 last year, which is a pretty significant decrease. And unfortunately, that trend is only going to increase from here. So that's really only the thin edge of the wedge. And I believe it's something around the middle of this century. They're looking at a halving of the Japanese population. And of course, as the population gets older and smaller, that can only mean that more and more retirees are being supported by fewer and fewer working people, which is going to be an unsustainable situation. In fact, it already is economically unsustainable, but it's only going to get worse and to sort of exacerbate that problem. So people
really don't understand the monster that we've created. We've actually promised all the older people, we're going to provide for you. You know, you're going to work hard and you're going to work through your productive years. You're going to put money in this trust fund, and that trust fund will be there when you retire. But the trouble is the politicians have spent all the money. Here in the United States, there is no money in the trust fund. We've got about 56, probably pushing 60 million Americans retired, and another 75, well, basically it was 78 million retiring, starting about 2 years ago, the baby boomers. There's no way there's going to be the money to provide for the benefits that have been promised to them. So they're going to have to start cutting back in one way or the other. But they don't want to tell the American people. They've been lying to them, and they've stolen all of the money out of the Social Security Trust Fund and the Medicare Trust Fund. It's a Ponzi scheme. Now, ladies and gentlemen, one fish, you have to spend everything that comes in because there's nothing to put aside. And then you've got to borrow money to make up for the rest of it. And one day, this whole house of cards is coming down. Give you a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, James, certainly we're going to have problems here in America just as you're having over there in Japan one of these days. I think maybe it will be a little longer getting to that. Right now the white population is reproducing about 1.67 children per family. Overall, we're still about 2.1 children per family, but that's just largely dependent upon the immigrants coming in, and certainly many of the immigrants are still having large families. How long that'll last, we certainly don't know. But the whole world's financial system looks to me like it's very, very, very fragile. What are your thoughts?
It is extremely fragile, and I want to bring this back to what you were just saying there about, for example, the ways that the markets are manipulated or directed by the types of things that we now take for granted. For example, Social Security is just one of those things that is basically accomplished by having these centralized government authorities that use tax money to subsidize various sectors and to put money into certain parts of the economy to the detriment of the free operations of the market. And I think we see this in a lot of different ways, but perhaps the biggest distorting factor in the markets is the central banks themselves, which, of course, are the ones that really direct and control the overall money supply, which is the biggest distortion that you can possibly have in a supposedly free market. And I think it's no coincidence that one of the major planks of the Communist Manifesto is that there should be a central bank to oversee the banking operations of a country, a communist country, because, of course, this is the one of the fundamental tenets of having a directed society, a centrally controlled society, a socialist society, basically, is to have that that power over the money supply. And that is such an incredibly distorting effect on the markets in general that it's difficult to even understand how distorting that really is. But basically, if you have people with the power to turn on or turn off the spigot of the money supply and to control inflation, that controls basically everything that happens in that economy. It directs, for example, what people are willing to put their money into or not put their money into. For example, people would be more willing to put their money into stocks if the central bank is turning on the money supply and turning on the spigots, because they know that the value of their money is decreasing, so they need to put it into something that will promise them a higher yield. So they'll be more likely to put it into the stock market, for example. And then there are other taxes and regulations that can affect the ways that people use their money. For example, if you put big capital gains taxes on things like precious metals, then people would be less likely to invest in them and more likely to put it into things like the stock market. And those types of distortions generally aren't even thought about at all and aren't taken into account by people who, again, want to blame the free market, quote-unquote capitalism, quote-unquote, for what's happening in these markets. But it's important to understand just how fundamentally these markets are controlled at the very top by these centralized agencies that have so much power to direct things like the creation of the money supply.
I certainly agree with you, and the tragedy is that most people really don't understand how the monetary system works, and certainly the importance of a central bank as opposed to an independent organization. Yet, of course, I think it works in total concert for the money powers, and is really not interested in preserving the value of the currency for the average individual, but I think it does what is best for the money powers, and they benefit, and unfortunately, I fear down the line, sooner or later, why this whole house of cards is coming down. And with it will be the destruction of our economy as we know it will be. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is James Corbett. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or out across America, 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, if you agree or disagree. But basically, James is simply pointing out that if you read the Communist Manifesto, point number 5 of the Communist Manifesto is the central bank. And yet, of course, all the governments, or certainly almost all of the governments today, do have an independent central bank, controlled by people who interlock certainly into a organized effort to control the economy of the world. And we do have a ruling elite, contrary to everything you're told. They determine the course of the economy, and they do that by controlling whether the central bank expands or contracts the money supply, and of course how they in turn are able to control the governments. Right now, of course, we're in a situation of austerity here in the United States, as they're cutting back certainly on government spending, and of course they're going to punish the people by, of course, right now, of course, they're just shutting down the airports, the people there are certainly working at the airports, FAA officials, and basically now they're going to be delayed flights all across America, 3 or 4 hours, and they're going to say, oh, shucks, well, it's the sequestration, it's just that we've cut back on federal government. Ladies and gentlemen, there are lots of places they could cut back on, like giving money to Egypt, like giving money to the terrorists over there in Syria, but they're not going to cut back on that. They're going to cut back on the FAA airports here so that the towers of the airports don't work. So you will be saying, well, we're just going to have to keep spending money. But if you keep spending money you don't have, sooner or later the day of reckoning comes. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest is James Corbett, and we're talking about what is really going on financially in the world. James, what are the important issues that our listeners should be addressing right now?
Well, just to take it back to what you were just saying, it's absolutely right that all of the cutbacks and austerity that they're attempting to bring in right now in the name of the budget problems is completely theatrics. And we can just look at a recent deal that was just signed, a $10 billion arms deal that was signed with Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. And basically, part of that deal includes $3 billion in military aid from the U.S. to Israel for the coming fiscal year. So again, the U.S. giving out billions and billions and billions of dollars to its so-called allies in aid and various forms of funding, whereas they're attempting to make it look like they just don't have money to keep the FAA fully manned and things like this. It's completely ridiculous. And it just goes to show it what's really behind this system. And unfortunately, again, so much of it does come down to military aid and military spending. And of course, the literally hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars that's being spent to maintain the fostering of the American empire all around the world, and the literally hundreds of countries where there are U.S. military bases and U.S. military forces stationed. So unfortunately, that's basically what the basis of the system is. A lot of the doom and gloom and the we have to shut down the government is completely theatrics, and unless people understand that, I think they will get caught in that political game of Republicans versus Democrats without realizing that the entire game has been bought and paid for a long time ago by the same few banking interests.
I think that's very well said. And anybody who'd really like to read a wonderful book about this, it's written by Professor Carol Quigley, who is a professor of history at Georgetown University. When he died, but he'd been both at Harvard and Princeton and Yale, I guess. And basically, of course, he was a liberal. He really understood what's going on. He believed we needed a ruling elite. And he talks about how the bankers really rule the world. But of course, he says you're not going to be able to do anything about it, but I just want you to know what's really going on. His book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, was actively suppressed for many, many years. It is available now through my ministry. And of course, it's a long story of how that got back in print. The last thing they wanted was for the American people to be able to read an authoritarian, authoritative, a liberal college professor who really tells the truth. And basically, they gave Professor Quigley a terrible, terrible time. Once he wrote a book that told the truth, the last thing they want is for the American people, indeed people throughout the world, is to realize we have a ruling elite that simply has no loyalty to nations. They have this loyalty to this dream. A one-world government, a one-world financial system, and the destruction of Christianity. Because what Professor Quigley missed is that behind this there are powerful, powerful spiritual forces. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. If you have a question for James Corbett, I guess this afternoon, give us a call. But basically, the world, I think, really believe, is on the edge of a financial cliff. It's not a matter of if, but when. And if you don't have a parachute, ladies and gentlemen, you're not going to survive. We'll be back in a moment. Give us a call. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is James Corbett, who writes a regular editorial every week and now twice a week for the International Forecaster. We have Sam calling us from Centervale. We'll get to him in just a moment. Our telephone number here at Radio Liberty, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY here in the Central Coast of California. It's 464-8295. That's 831-464-8295. You can give us a call. But before we get to Sam, would you like to tell our listeners how they can certainly get to the International Forecaster and get that material? And, of course, certainly our guest, James Corbett, writes his own financial, not newsletter, but certainly analysis, I suppose. He's not considered a financial consultant, although I would listen very carefully to what he has to say. But, Sam, pardon me, James, how can people get in touch with the International Forecaster, and how can they get in touch with you?
Yes, well, thank you. Of course, as you indicate, the Forecaster comes out twice a week on Wednesdays and Saturdays, and it's about 40 pages each time, including not only, of course, my analysis, but a lot of analysis from other commentators and news roundup, lots of information packed into every issue. So people who are interested in that can go to the International Forecaster website, theinternationalforecaster.com, where they can find out more information. They can see some of the example articles. They can get an introductory copy if they haven't seen the forecaster before. And if they're interested in subscribing, there's information there on how they can do that. Once again, that's theinternationalforecaster.com. And for those people who are not online, you can write in via snail mail. You can write in P.O. Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida 33883. Once again, that's P.O. Box 7752, Winter Haven, Florida 33883, and they can find out more information that way. And if they're interested in my own website and my own work, that's CorbettReport.com, CorbettReport.com. As you indicate, I have a weekly newsletter that includes not only my International Forecaster editorial, but also recommended reading and viewing. And once a month, I have a subscriber-only video that goes out with that. I also have DVDs for sale for people who want to support my work. So again, all of that is available at CorbettReport.com.
Okay, fine. Well, let's go to Sam, who's calling us from Sunnyvale, California. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 831-464-8295. And Sam, do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, my question is, how does this recent outbreak of terror, you know, the Boston Marathon, how does that fit into this picture? Because it seems like it either was it planned or was if it was unplanned, because it certainly seems to sabotage, you know, Obama's area of immigration and outreach to Muslims. Obviously, he's either incompetent or he's actually for the terrorists. It certainly doesn't do him any good. So how does this fit into the overall picture of the decline of the economy and the oligarchy?
It's a good question.
All right, James, do you have any thoughts at all about that?
Absolutely, I do. It's a good question because, of course, what we saw, for example, in the wake of 9/11 was the excuse to drop interest rates to basically nothing and run up the housing bubble. That was basically the start of the Greenspan housing bubble era. So it's always important to keep your eye on events like these and how it might have macroeconomic effects. But I would say that the main immediate effects of this Boston bombing hysteria is going to be the geopolitical effects. And what we're likely to see playing out is not only a greater increase in attention in the North Caucasus region with Dagestan and Chechnya there, right on the doorstep of Russia, but we might see how this might play out into a carrot and stick situation between the United States and Russia for Russia to potentially remove their block on U.S. forces in Syria. So I think in the next couple of weeks, it's going to become more clear how this is going to play out geopolitically. We're definitely going to have to keep our eye on that. I am, of course, suspicious about the entire story regarding the Boston bombing and whether the Tsarnaev brothers were even actually involved in it. But at any rate, it does provide that convenient excuse to focus attention on an area that I've been covering in my work for some time now and saying that basically this North Caucasus Central Asia region is going to become the focus in the near future. And lo and behold, here we are with such an incredible focus on this region right now. So again, I think we'll see in the next couple of weeks what this means geopolitically and economically. I'm not sure that there's a big effect yet, but this could be the start of a new campaign in the war on terror, which might again affect the macroeconomic situation.
Let me just add that I believe, of course, everything that is going on today is aimed at getting us to hate the Muslims. I mean, the Muslims are terrible people. They're all bad, you know, and we have them here in a minute. This is what they want us to believe, of course. I think most of the Muslims who live in America just like to get away from all this extremist of religion. But basically, this whole world financial movement, this whole world, I said, that terror movement has been funded by the West since its inception. We carry a book called The Devil's Game, written back in 19. It starts out talking about what happened in 1928 when MI6, British intelligence, started funding the Muslim Brotherhood. Why? Well, because then you could play the radical Islamists against the existing secular government and play both sides. And then, of course, after the Second World War, Britain was pretty well bankrupt, and so the CIA took this over, and the CIA has been funding this whole radical movement, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, ever since then. But if you don't believe that, so to go up on the Internet and simply write down CIA funds Al-Qaeda or CIA funds ISI, which is Pakistani intelligence, and you'll find that CIA funds Pakistani intelligence, ISI, and then write down ISI funds Al-Qaeda, and you'll find that's right. Remember, of course, that certainly in the year 2009, when Barack Obama put an extra 30,000 American troops into Afghanistan. We already had 60,000. He put in another 20,000. There were 45,000 NATO troops, 100,000 contractors we pay for, 300,000 Afghan troops and police we pay for, and there were less than 100 members of Al-Qaeda. You can find that up on the Internet. You can see the 60-minute program, December 2009, where Steve Croft asked President Obama why we're sending additional 30,000 troops when there's only less than 100 members of Al-Qaeda over there in Afghanistan. And Obama, without even blinking an eye, says, because they're plotting against America, and my job is to defend America. That's why we're sending an additional 30,000 American troops. And, Sam, nobody's going to tell you. It's all as phony is a $3 bill, but now we've toppled the governments in Egypt and in Tunisia and certainly in Libya, and we're toppling the government in Syria. We've already toppled the government in Turkey. They are now certainly a radical Islamic government. We instituted Sharia law in both Afghanistan and in Iraq. We're setting everything up under the control of a radical Islamist for a great war that's coming in that area. I think that's what it's all about. At least that's my interpretation of it. Do you have anything to say, Sam?
Yes. Okay. So, what can the ordinary citizen do? So I'm in a Tea Party. So, should I urge my Congress person to or woman here to investigate that, or set up some kind of committee to check what our government's doing and thus expose this overall scenario? Or how can the average citizen help with this unraveling this thing?
All right, James. What would you say in response to Sam's question?
Well, I wouldn't dissuade anyone from that type of political action if that's what they feel will be effective. But I think probably the best and most effective thing that people can do right now is to spread this type of information directly, either whatever that might be, either water cooler talk, if that's what it is, or sending out emails or creating YouTube videos or using Twitter or whatever it is that you use to get this information out there. I think we are having an incredible effect on the mainstream discourse right now, and you can see that in the way of this Boston bombing hysteria, that false flag became a trending topic on Google. It's on the tip of everyone's tongue. Even mainstream publications, even Yahoo News and the like, are covering the possibility of the government being involved in the bombing itself. So I think we've seen a fundamental shift in consciousness over the last 10 years between what happened in the wake of 9/11, where everyone basically swallowed the government story hook, line, and sinker. And now we've got even mainstream news sites starting to question or at least put out the idea that the government might be behind things like this. That is an incredible shift, and that shift is not happening because of political pressure or anything of that sort. It's coming because so many people are talking about this and spreading the word online and in real life to their friends and family. It is creating a buzz, and I think we have to continue to push this. I think that's the most effective thing that people can be doing right now, spreading the word individually, person to person, because I think we are having an incredible effect.
And I agree with it totally. Let me point out, Sam, there was a survey done about 2 weeks ago, but it's something called the public policy polling. It was reported on certainly Alex Jones' Prison Planet. But this is a left-wing polling. They did a polling of certain people, and they asked the questions like, do you really believe that there's a secret group that's running the world and moving towards a world government and conspiring to do this? And, you know, because they were trying to play down this idea of a conspiracy. And 28% of the people that they interviewed believed that that was absolutely true. 28% believed that there was actually this conspiracy to bring about a world government. And basically, it was actually, as I recall, 38% of the people who voted for Mitt Romney believed that. I think 35% didn't, but 38% did. I think we're making great strides, Sam, and you need to help us get people listening to programs like ours and like Joyce Riley and Sean Leffler and Alex Jones and certainly Chuck Chrismeyer. And there's all sorts of programs up there on the Internet. We've never had access to the people before. And despite the fact they control the mainline media and they control have a lot of disinformation on the Internet, there's a lot of good programs up there as well. So we're making progress. Don't get discouraged. I've been at this for 50 years. I'm more optimistic than I've ever been. Anything else you'd like to say, Sam?
I think there's any chance that there would be some kind of minority group within the existing Republican Party that would press for a thorough, you know, public investigation, because I know there's a lot of offline controversy, but what about doing something in the main mainline media or the government itself within the Congress? Any chance of that?
I would say pretty much zero chance, and anything that would be accomplished by, for example, the Republicans trying to bring pressure on this would be swirling around the types of false paradigm that they want to keep us locked in. I don't think anyone is going to be launching a congressional investigation into, for example, the FBI's history with the Tsarnaev brothers, although that is starting to come out. But of course, you notice it was after RT interviewed the Tsarnaev brothers' mother, and she said that the FBI had been in contact with them for years. Then the FBI, after that point, confirmed that they had in fact interviewed these people. So I don't think it's going to start from a congressional investigation or anything of that sort. And again, if people think that that's a possibility, then by all means, they can put pressure on their congressman. But again, I think that it's going to be more effective to start to go around that system entirely, because I just don't see any change happening on Capitol Hill. And unfortunately, that's coming from decades and decades of experience of what's happened in the past with terror events like these. The real meat and potatoes of this is not going to be arrived at through congressional investigation.
And Sam, the most important thing we can do is get people to understand the media is controlled, number one. Number two is there's a small group that controls our government. And if you haven't read Barry Goldwater's book, With No Apologies, page 280, we have used copies of the book available. There he talks about how the Trilateral Commission, their goal is to take control of the political and economic power of the world by first seizing political control of the American government. That's his words, not mine. By first seizing political control of the American government, he's talking about David Rockefeller's Trilateral Commission. They do. And remember, simply, and you need to get these things down and listen to what we say because they're accurate. Between 1977 and the year 2008, every president and or vice president of the United States came from the membership roles of the Trilateral Commission, six of the eight presidents of the World Bank, eight of the 10 U.S. trade representatives, seven of the 12 secretaries of state, and nine of the 12 secretaries of defense. Do you really think we have a representative government? There's never been more than 80 members of the North American chapter of the Trilateral Commission. Go to their website, learn about them, look at their logo, understand they are a satanic organization. When you understand that, then read my book and just help us get the word out, Sam. We're making progress, but you're going to have to be out there on the front lines. I can't do much more than I do right now. God bless. We've got a full board, but thanks for calling. Let's go to George calling from Toronto. Hi, George. You have a question or comment?
I'd like to ask James. Oh, thanks, Dr. Stan. I'd like to ask James, what do you think of Vladimir Putin, friend or foe, and why isn't the U.S. get a little bit closer to Russia, maybe for economic purposes and such?
Now, what do you think of Vladimir Putin? Why don't we get closer to Russia?
This is an extremely important question, and it's one of these pieces of the puzzle that don't quite fit in quite yet, because the mainstream image is that there is a type of tension right now between the U.S. and Russia because Putin stands up to the U.S., etc. But there is the question as to how much Putin plays along with this the game that's being played out in the international media, and this goes back to some of the fundamental things that, for example, Russia obviously knows. Not only about this particular Boston incident, but a lot of the terror incidents of the past decades. For example, people who have been listening to my series of interviews with FBI whistleblower Sibel Edmonds knows that, for example, Ayman al-Zawahiri was captured and detained in Russia for 6 months back in the 1990s, during which time, supposedly, they weren't able to access his laptop or get it translated because there was no one in all of Russia, supposedly, who could translate the contents of his laptop. Etc., etc. We see these types of things again and again, and now we find out that the FSB, the Russian CIA, had warned the FBI about these Tsarnaev brothers a couple of years ago. Why isn't Russia coming out with everything that they do know about these situations and exposing the war on terror paradigm as the fraud that it is? I think there's a good question as to whether they are playing along and to how much, what great extent they are playing along. And this is something that I just covered in a new interview with Sibel Edmonds that I just did, a one-hour interview about this and the geopolitical implications of the Boston bombing. That'll be out on my website later today, so I hope people stay tuned for that.
And so, Well, it's certainly one of our Sibel issues, rather than Sibel. But Sibel certainly is one of my favorite guests, and I'm so glad you're getting her on and getting her exposure. She's a very courageous lady. Anything else you'd like to ask, George?
I just don't know about the U.S. intelligence, how good it really is. They seem to be messing up a lot.
You have to understand, they don't make any mistakes. They know exactly what they're doing. They want to appear to be the fumbling idiots. They know exactly what they're doing. But believe me, they were monitoring everything going on and what you saw. I said, whether it be at 9/11, you didn't see what really happened. Those buildings came down by controlled demolition. And I don't know what happened in Boston. Well, what part these boys played, I think they played some part in it, but there were other people obviously involved, and now suddenly they're saying, hey, you know, actually there were 12 other people involved in this cell. Well, how do they know there were 12? I mean, at this point, how would they possibly know there were 12 unless this whole thing had organized? Where did this young man, the older brother, get enough money to go to last year to Russia and to Chechnya? And spent 6 months. Now he's got a wife. He's got a 3-year-old child. He has no source of income. Where did he get? He go to college? Where did he get the funds to go over there? I couldn't afford to go over there for that length of time. Obviously, he's getting paid by somebody, and the question is it Russian money or is it American tax money? Hey, thanks for calling.
Doctor.
Okay, fine. Let's see. Bruce, are you there? Bruce, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I sure can. Okay, do you have a question or comment for our guest?
One here. Has the North Korean threat to put people on edge in Japan, or are they laughing about it? Has Mr. Kim Jong been shown to be a blowhard, or do they really take him seriously?
That's a good question. I would say that basically the Japanese people are not taking it particularly seriously, and it's not something that people are exactly on edge about. I don't think people are really losing any sleep over that situation. And I think the cards were exposed last week when Kim Jong-un came out with his conditions for future talks with Korea, which I think was basically what this has mostly been about, is basically just rattling the saber to get at people's attention to try to get the negotiators back to the table. So I think this looks kind of like this recent hysteria was just part of that longer cycle, and North Korea hasn't given any indication that it was anything fundamentally different.
Well, I heard a commentator last week say that he was surprised Japan had cruisers. Has the amount of money spent on the Japanese defense program increased at a critical step somewhere that we weren't paying attention to?
As a matter of fact, it has. Certainly in the last several months, there's been an incredible increase in the budget here, and there's been, for the last several years, there's been more and more of an effort to try to not only to increase the size of the Japanese military, but to start to change the constitution, which supposedly prevents Japan from having any but self-defense capabilities. They want to change that part of the constitution to allow Japan to have a full army. So that is growing, and events like what we just saw with North Korea, those types of saber-rattling events only add to that that fire. So although the general Japanese population isn't losing sleep over this, it is a convenient excuse for the Japanese government to increase their budget, increase their spending, and increase their military cooperation with the U.S.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, fine. Well, thank you so very much for calling. And, of course, our guest has been James Corbett. James, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure to have you here.
I'm looking forward to next week. Thank you.